Ah, there we are. You're tuned in to the Community Character Hour here on 88.5 KRFY, where everything is a little shaky as we wrap up our County Fair live broadcast of last week. But the equipment seems to work again, and we begin the program with a newspaper clipping from the past. What have we got today, Hannah Combs?
Today's newspaper article comes from the Kootenai County Republican on November 26th, 1901. And this is a sort of a from around the world article sharing an event that happened in New York City. In the presence of a big crowd, which, despite the storm, assembled to witness the emerging of the submarine boat Fulton, that craft rose from the bottom of the iconic bay, which is at the eastern end of Long Island, at 10:30 o'clock, with all well and greatly surprised that there was a storm raging. The bulk of the Fulton's staying qualities was highly satisfactory, not only to the officers of the company that built it and the naval officers present, but those who went to the bottom in the boat. They report there was not the slightest discomfort to them during more than 15 hours of submergence below the surface of the water. Captain Cable, who was in charge of the boat, reports that there was a soft rolling motion to the craft, but it was ascribed to rolling waves up on the shore. In coming to the surface, the Fulton, under her own power, ran alongside the dock and tied up. Rear Admiral Lowe and Lieutenant Arthur MacArthur refused to go into a discussion of the performance of the boat, except to say they would be reluctant to stay down longer. They are, however, known to be enthusiastic about the work of the Fulton thus far. Members of the crew say they experienced no difficulty in breathing and that the air was all that could be expected and much purer and better than in an ordinarily closed room in which there are several persons. Every piece of machinery worked to perfection during the night. The men ate their meals while underwater and enjoyed them. Most of them obtained 3 or 4 hours sleep.
Well, that's very okay. I have questions about that, but welcome, welcome everyone to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack from KRFY here with Hannah Combs, director of the Bonner County Historical Society in Museum. Heather Upton will be joining us shortly. She's director emeritus of said museum, and our guest this month is local historian Ken Conger. Good morning to you, Ken.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Before we talk to Ken about, well, I guess you can imagine what we're going to talk to Ken about. The Fulton was down for 15 hours. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Arthur MacArthur was, and his boss, Rear Admiral Lowe, said that it sounds like it was a pleasant stay. Underwater.
Yes. Do you want to know how deep they were under the water?
Yes, I do.
They were about 15 feet. So okay. It said previously in the article that the very top of the submarine was about 5 feet under the surface. Uh-huh. Yeah, and this was a test they did. So a few fun facts I learned while reading this. This submarine was not the very first submarine ever built, but it was named after the man who first kind of invented the submersible. He was, Ken, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe he was working in France, but Fulton doesn't sound like a French name. But he was the first one who was kind of testing them and coming up with them conceptually. So think of Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. There was a lot of kind of concepts behind the idea of a submersible vessel before they were actually able to test them. So, but they did exist before 1901. This was just the first time that they were seeing how long it could stay underwater with no adverse effects. So this was, the Fulton test in 1901 was testing things like, would the men be okay psychologically being stuck in a small vessel like that? Would there be any off-gassing from the mechanical parts of the ship that could poison them? how could they maintain a normal routine of eating meals and sleeping on shifts? So could this actually be a functioning military vessel is what the Navy was testing with this, with the Fulton in its 15 feet of water off a wharf in Long Island. So this was kind of the start of submarines being used as a military vessel.
Mm-hmm. They were used in the Civil War. Or one was used in the Civil War, I think.
Really?
Ken probably knows about that as well. Just one, and then I think, because they weren't used to it. They were learning as they went, and it fired a torpedo, which hit the ship, and then the shockwave from the explosion killed everybody in the submarine.
Oh my gosh!
I know.
And they found it, relatively recently, in the last 20 years.
Really?
And they found the dog tags of the people, identification, and wow. They've got it reconstructed, I think, South Carolina, somewhere down in that area.
So it was off the coast of the Carolinas?
Probably in a river, one of the rivers.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Ken is here to talk about, what do you think? Submarines.
In Lake Pendere.
In Lake Pendere.
Or are we?
This is the old rumor that everybody has heard, I think, about Lake Pendere. It's one of the first things you probably hear when you either move here or visit. You hear this is a deep lake. Why it's so deep that the Navy uses it to test submarines. That's the story we all hear.
Should we just throw out all of the rumors we've heard that they have submarines at 1,000 feet under the water, that they're doing secret missions in Lake Pendere, that I don't know what else.
Yeah,
my favorite is that the reason they're here is that they can sneak out through the Rathdrum Aquifer to get to the Columbia River.
So the
Soviet satellites can't see them.
That is a great one.
Yes. I have long imagined, I think I read too much Jules Verne, but mysterious tunnels between the lake and the aquifer that you could travel through.
Well, if you were in that 1970s movie, The Incredible Voyage, where they shrank the submarine and the men down to go inside a body to heal something.
This sounds like an episode of The Magic School Bus.
So then you could perhaps, then it would be practical to try and escape, yes, the lake through the Rathdrum Aquifer, but otherwise probably unlikely that you're going to make it to the Columbia from here. Let's see. So we invited you, we asked you a few weeks ago if you'd like to come in and tell us what you know about submarines in Lake Pendere, and I guess... we can begin by asking, is it true? Is this a true story that there really are or have been submarines under the surface of Lake Pendere?
And my first answer to you was?
Yes, but not in the way that you think, I think is what, not in the way you picture. Is that about right?
Well, I think it's my English teacher in high school would love me now because words matter. And if you hear the comment saying that submarine research is being done, everybody thinks of these large cylindrical things that men get into and go under the water. Well, submarine also is the study of fish and lake bottoms and plankton and So that when you're doing submarine research, you could be doing all sorts of things. So that the main reason the Navy has been doing research here for over 75 or 80 years is because it's a quiet lake. Is the inlets and outlets are clear at the north end of the lake. The deepest end of the lake is at the southern end, and it has a muddy bottom, and it's flat bottom, and there is an isocline, which is a layer of temperature change below which it does not change, and that the 100 feet down, it's 39 degrees year-round and doesn't change.
Is that similar to how in a cave it's always the same temperature once you get to a certain depth?
Because there's no heating from the sun and cooling from snow and the weather outside, correct? Yeah, that. And then if you go down in the mines in Silver Valley, they get hot because close, you know, 3 miles down, it's the ground is warmer. So that when you're looking at sound, and that is the reason that they do their research here, is both in producing sound, trying to make the submarines quieter, and how to detect other submarines with the sonar, you know, that either passive or active sonar, where you send out a ping, it bounces off something, it comes back, and you can see how far away it is or how big it is.
So these are sort of ideal conditions in Lake Pendray for testing the sonar aspects of submersible vessels.
Yes.
I feel like we're going to be breaking a lot of myths.
Exactly.
That have been told, you know, about the submarine. And I always was told it was just because the lake was so deep, which is part of that. The depth creates the conditions, but it's really the conditions. That's super fascinating.
Yeah, the conditions 100 feet down.
Wow.
Hmm. So there's about 1,000 feet more below that. Hmm. And the sonar research is not something new. That Seneca Lake, which upstate New York, which also had a World War II Navy training base on it, similar to Farragut, did sonar research there at 600 feet in 1942. And then there was other places in California during the war that they were doing research. And that when they sold off all of the property of Farragut Naval Training Station, the Navy kept about 50 acres, and they didn't know what they were going to do with it until a couple years later.
So the sonar research was not happening in
during
the lake
the
at the same time that it was a naval training center.
100%. So you will meet people who said, my dad or my grandpa trained to be a submariner at Farragut. Well, technically, yes. Is that every Navy sailor goes through boot camp, and then they can go to radio school or cooking school or any of the other schools that were at Farragut.
If I'm correct, they also learned to swim at Farragut, which
you had
arguably
to.
Could be submarine training.
That's right. Yeah, that you had to be able to swim 75 yards before you left boot camp.
It's a good place to learn to
swim.
It
is. That's a good skill for a sailor to have, I suppose, the ability to swim at least 75 yards. But during World War II, Farragut, when it was at the time like the largest, you know, technically the largest city or population in Idaho, I think, was not being used for any kind of sonar or submarine research or development or anything like that. It wasn't until after.
And yes, and it, one of the biggest myths is that the training station was here because of the lake.
Mm, well, another.
And not they human. Didn't need a big lake. Mm. Everybody that has gone through boot camp in San Diego or Great Lakes or Seneca Lake, where I was talking about, never went more than 500 yards offshore. So that you needed a 10-acre lake to spend 4 hours learning how to row a lifeboat. And that is the only reason that they had a lake.
So they could have done that at Round Lake.
Yes.
Okay.
Huh. You're blowing our minds this morning.
Yeah.
Well, how lucky were they to have such a picturesque setting for what could have been done in many, many other places.
Yeah, most certainly.
Okay, I have another myth for you to blow out of the water. I have heard that, I guess this is getting into Farragut territory, so we can come back to this at another show, but the myth that Eleanor Roosevelt was flying to a conference in Seattle and saw Lake Pendere from the plane and called up FDR on the plane phone and said, "We must, I found the perfect place for your top secret submarine research center."
I love this one. And you have to, again, put yourself in the time frame. She wasn't going to a conference. She had a daughter that had married a newspaper man, and they were living on the island between Bellevue and Seattle. And he was quite wealthy. It was a Hearst newspaper. And she would go out one or two times a year to see the grandbabies during the her husband's presidency. And yes, would take the trains, so she would go right by our little little town here. She would also take the train south, come up from California. But they would also fly commercial. That they did not have Air Force Ones, yeah. And they did not have access
the phone
to
and Air Force Ones.
And, so that they were flying commercial, and there was no GPS. There was only what was called the Airways. And that if you look at a 1940 Airways, it's basically the road map in the sky showing how you fly from point to point. And they had radio beacons and arrows on the ground out in the desert, and arrows on buildings and numbers on lookouts.
Oh, wow.
So that is how they flew around. So that she would have flown if she came through... She would have come up the canyon, 4th of July Canyon from Missoula, up and over, flown straight across Coeur d'Alene on to Phelps Field and then off to Moses Lake and into Everett or Seattle. And that they were not pressurized planes during the war for civilians, and so that they would have had to have stayed below 15,000 feet. And the airwaves on the maps actually have the elevation going east and going west where they had to fly at, so they wouldn't run into each other. And so, of course, that map takes them literally across the fairgrounds in Coeur d'Alene. And at 10,000 feet, which is about 5,000-6,000 feet above the ground, you can see Lake Pendere. Just a tiny little sliver. What you do see is Lake Coeur d'Alene and Hayden Lake. And so two things of that is, no, she couldn't have seen it because they didn't fly straight over the mountains. Two, they didn't need a big lake. And three, do you really think that Eleanor Roosevelt was sitting down in these smoke-filled rooms with all these admirals and captains, deciding which states get what kind of war booty and war industry.
That's what makes it so magical, right, Hannah?
I wouldn't put that past her, but I also imagine she might have been preoccupied with thinking about her grandchildren when she was getting that close.
That's
to
a good
Seattle.
Point. What a great story, though.
I know. It makes you wonder how this lore develops. How do people?
I think now it's
Facebook,
but back then it's just word of mouth.
Yeah.
Some bunko party. Mm-hmm. You know, did you hear?
They had bunko in the 40s?
Well, I see.
So, cards. So getting back to, I guess, our topic today. So after for whatever reason, Farragut ended up here. And then after the war and the actual naval training station is, I don't know, decommissioned or demobilized, whatever, then when does it start to become an area of interest for the Navy? And in what way does it, do they start doing this sonar acoustical research or whatever they are doing? As far as you know,
the big thing is because it's technology and our enemies would love to get a hold of anything that we develop that's better than theirs. This has been cloaked in secrecy. So finding things other than just the newspaper articles of when something really, really does happen, it's hard to find. And I've been to the National Archives on two occasions looking for information. And what I found was the sales of buildings and contracts for building new equipment and things like that. And so that the Army, or the Navy, left 22 acres there, and that by 1946, it's being called the David Taylor Model Basin Field Station at Farragut. And David Taylor was a naval engineer that graduated in Annapolis right after the Civil War, and really was the first naval architect and started designing ships and developed a waterway. Think of a very long swimming pool that then they set up gantries on to run ship models through to test drag and things like that. So that is who David Taylor is. And so this was in honor of him. So it was always known as the David Taylor Model Basin. And I've got a 1952 Naval Air Station, Washington, aerial photograph of it in 1951, and it's labeled as the David Taylor Basin. And of course, it's classified photograph at that time and things. Senator Dworshak, we've got a dam in North Idaho named after him for some reason, in May of 47, made a comment in an article that says, "The only activity on Lake Pendere is a small and confidential scientific operation. Rumor denied."
Can you explain? I'm just thinking about that risk of espionage. So I imagine in today's world, a lot of the risk or threat with spying and stealing technology is kind of done through satellite imagery. Before we had thousands of satellites up in the air, how could other people have been trying to get information about this research center?
In 1980, we took a rented boat and drove around the facility and took pictures of the barge off of Bayview. It's not the barge that is there now. And all over that building were signs that says no photographs. And so I couldn't find my photograph of that sign, but it's a 100-foot long barge that eventually sank. But yes, all of the above is you would be a worker. You would have a cabin somewhere, and you could just take pictures of the comings and goings.
So you would plant a mole.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so that if you're listening, if it's acoustic research, you could have your own hydrophone and be listening to the frequencies that they're using.
Just have a fishing boat and drop something over the side.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
I think you would have been doing that, Ken.
Just out of curiosity. No ill intent.
Well, what's funny is my brother had a fishing boat, and we were out on the Monarchs one time, and he had just got a new fish finder, and we were jumping off the boat and swimming. And I climbed back on board, and I look down, and it's 800 or 900 feet, and I go, "Oh my gosh, we're in the deep end." Mm-hmm. Yeah, that there's an article in the 50s that the United States Geologic Society Association actually then came and mapped and tested the depth. And that in my geology research, the Navy has released one photograph of their soundings of the bottom showing that it is flat and that there's another 1,000 feet of gravel in the bottom.
Wow.
So that means that riverbed that used to be here at the foot of the mountains was that far down.
Wow. That's wild.
So spies, everywhere, the honeypot, people sleeping with the captain. And
oh. Let's talk a little bit more about that. That's for another show.
Heather's going to make a movie.
Only if you're a part intrigue. This is so fun. So you're talking about in the 80s, you're just immediately drawn. When did you come here personally? And was Farragut part of the draw? Because you're such an expert and fan.
No, my wife was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she grew up here. And okay. So that had met her at the University of Idaho, and we'd been dating for several months and came up here. So this trip was before I even had met her. So,
oh, okay.
Just some people in our apartment complex, somebody had a boat at Bayview, and so we came up during the summer.
But this sounds like it's been a beacon for you.
Oh, no. I've just, everywhere I go, I learn something like this. And
gotcha.
Since we've stayed here longer, I've just gotten deeper and deeper. And yes, it's the myths and mm-hmm. the misstatements that have driven me to kind of write the record.
That's incredible.
And so that,
you know. We're lucky to have you in our area doing this hard work. Amazing.
That's not just a.
So you're holding up a picture right now. If only we could be filmed as well.
So this one looks like a submersible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to call it a submarine so that I can say that it's a yellow submarine.
It looks like a yellow kind of balloon, like smaller.
Mm. Yeah, just like a little blimp almost with a tail.
Hmm.
Hmm.
So when it shows up at Hope and is unloaded at Hope, or the larger ones, one came in on rail car, and they were going to do it at Hope and put a whole bunch of cranes in. And so let's back up a little bit. What we're talking about is once the research really started, they first were just calibrating sonar equipment. So they would have tests, distances, and sizes of things they would lower down. And then in 1967, they started bringing in fifth and half quarter scale submarines, what we think of as submarine. And some of them are just drones that they would tether them down to the 1,000-foot level and then just release them and then control them like a drone coming up, so that they could regulate the speed. And in doing that, they would develop the shape so that the World War II submarines looked like ships. Well, when nobody had sonar making a lot of noise in the water, it didn't matter. But once we started learning that sonar, the shape of the nose needed to be more rounded, that's when we go from the ship-looking submarines mm-hmm. to these round ones. And this 1967 picture, or 87, it doesn't have the dome on it yet.
Mm.
So that this one picture...
67 was when the dome was really starting to come about?
50s, early 50s. 50s. So the Nautilus and those earlier ones, the submarine that is... on display in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
Was, I think, retrofitted with a rounder nose because they found that it was more quiet. And then also the front of the rounded portion has hydrophones in it, which is a microphone for underwater, hydrophone. And so that it is the big flashlight as it's just listening in front of it. So that, you know, a whale barks and the sound bounces off of something in front of them, and then they can just hear that.
It looks like a whale.
Yeah.
So great inspiration.
And so that they started developing these small devices, then went to what was called the large models. And we've had them all named after fish. There's the Kokanee and Kamloops, and Cutthroat is the most.
But then I'm also seeing Beluga.
Well, that's the nickname of it. I've not come up with the real name, and that's that funny yellow submarine.
Okay.
That a friend, I think it's Bob Kennedy, who his dad or grandfather ran the barge company out of Hope that hauled everything, including the first Bonner General Hospital up here.
Wow. So are you saying that the Beatles were here and also inspired?
Yes. When I look under my porch, there are Beatles.
So good.
So I have a question about the size of them. You said they were a quarter scale, roughly, to what would ultimately be used in the ocean. But they weren't built here. They were shipped in by rail.
Some more recent ones have been built here.
Okay.
And so that I believe, again, difficult. I've not gone and asked them. Mm-hmm. But when you see something like the keel laying happened at Bayview on the cutthroat, that makes you think that it literally was built here.
Yeah. So some of these, even though they are a small model, they still look too big to fit on a standard rail car, which makes me wonder. It seems like another kind of security risk to have something that big being shipped all the way across the country on a train where anyone could potentially see it and study it.
And probably a lot. For instance, the propeller on our current submarines, and now we're going on to a propulsor, or kind of a jet engine kind of thing, you never ever saw it. They were developed. One of these boats had 50 to 75 different propellers on it as they dragged it through the water to see what sounds it made. So that just like the bubbles come out of your soda pop or the beer, bubbles will form on a moving object in the water. And then when those bubbles pop, it makes noise that then you can hear. And so if anybody's listened to any of, or watched any of the war movies, the more recent Hunt for Red October, etc., once we've got good sonar, each submarine, even each propeller, makes its own unique sound. So they will say it's a this class, and it probably is this, because it's spinning at whatever speed, different things like that. So that the things that are visible are covered. Most things that have something to do with sound looks just like the stuff behind Jack's dashboard here, is it's just wires and switches.
Okay.
And so that by looking at it, you would not know anything about it.
Can you give me an idea, when you're in open water, what's the range of how close do you have to be to a submarine to be able to pick up that sonar and hear that there is some sort of vehicle nearby?
Well, let's go back to history.
Okay.
That the USS Indianapolis, the famous ship that took the plutonium core for a Fat Man that we dropped on Nagasaki, left the bomb parts and then was headed to the Philippines without escorts. And the Japanese captain of the submarine that sank it testified that in the open ocean, more than 10 miles away, they could hear dishes being washed in the ship. So that's World War II.
Wow.
Our acoustics will hear a whale breach or make sounds 100 miles away. So that's the reason why we're here back at Lake Ponderay, is we don't have snapping shrimp. We don't have trawlers 80 miles away or 100 miles away that are making noise. It's very, very quiet.
So as part of the research that they do with sonar on how to sift through all of that interference?
That is, yes. And that's not stuff that they would do here.
Okay.
That's developed at places like MIT and, mm-hmm. and companies that develop the sonars. But the silence of this lake is bothered by fishing boats.
Mm-hmm.
So when do they usually go and do their runs?
At night.
Which adds to the mystique.
Extra spooky. That's interesting. So these all these things that we've seen pictures of, the listeners haven't, but they're all scale mod. They're built specifically for this purpose. None of them would ever have found later use out on the ocean or anything like that, or in any other setting except for sonar testing.
Yes, because they are mm-hmm. just like a server room. Mm-hmm. There's large banks of batteries. So the ones that don't get tethered, there's ones mm-hmm. that go back and forth at different depths and things. Forgot to say that down at the south end of the lake, an entire region has 100 hydrophones at depths hanging down on buoys and anchors. And then it's fiber optic back to Bayview so that they can take in the data, and so that they will tow the objects out there to be researched, and know that they are purely a research tool, and that they will modify them and change this and change that, change the skin. The former CO came up here to Rotary several years ago, and he said that even the soundproofing on the ice maker of submarines was developed here.
Wow.
So that they would, when you hear that the ice maker dump ice, it's made it a section of ice that it dumps and rattles. And of course, like I said, the dishes can make sound. And then the sound damping of the skin, I'm sure that some of those holes you would not be allowed to touch because they may be some special plastic or, many possibilities, ceramic, things that would have a different acoustic sound.
From an innovative standpoint with the submarines and different materials, do you know if there were some fascinating household items that were made? Like, did the submarine make Tupperware?
You mean the burp?
But you know how like a new material
it
comes
eventually
into
becomes
play?
A civilian application
product?
Hmm.
It's a good question.
Not here that I know of, but things like your Bose noise canceling headphones is that the way camouflage works is you make something look like the background. Well, if you have hydrophones, can hear the background noise, the snapping turtles or whatever, and then turn around and transmit that back out in a different direction, then it didn't sound like it bounced off you. So that there's all sorts of things like that.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
My favorite household product is Teflon that was developed because when they were working on the uranium in processing it, it kept sticking to the crucibles. And so they came up with a nonstick coating for their crucibles.
Mm. That's fascinating.
It is so interesting how certain aspects of this research remain
secret.
Classified.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. For, at least through the present day, but others wind up being what we put on the inside of our frying pans.
Yeah.
Yeah, that what was so funny is in the last couple of years, and you were involved with the Idaho PBS show, the Sagebrush Navy, and I had a Farragut display there and met some of the people, and then my wife Kathy and I were fortunate to receive tickets to go back and see the christening of the USS Idaho.
Wow, so exciting.
And we were able to tour it. And
is this a full size submarine?
No, yeah, it's the attack submarine, the Virginia class submarine.
Dream date for Kathy?
A dream date?
Yeah.
You better believe it.
I love that.
It was her
match
idea.
Match made in heaven.
Is, I was working on the road when the crew came around for the first time about four years ago, mm-hmm. and had a talk at the community center.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some crew that they're the crew of the ship as it's being built, that they once they rotated through in 2 years. They didn't get to, you know, launch the boat. Mm-hmm. And there was one, I think it was a radioman from Hayden, so a grandson of the Super One founder. Oh, yeah. And he had done his qualification and got his dolphins given to him in front of Super One in Hayden. Oh. So that they'd toured in. And my wife just fell in love with the guys, that they were so professional, and they're all scientists. And it's the submarine force is something that's unbelievable. Is first, you've got to have a temperament to be underwater and shoulder to shoulder with 90 guys. Unlike the World War II boats, these are nuclear and they make their own water, so you can shower twice a day. Mm-hmm. In the World War II boats, you showered when you got home, and only the cook and sometimes the corpsman got to shower.
Because all of the water you could use had to be
to the batteries.
On
yeah, well, they could make out of seawater, but they had batteries
so
that
how did
needed.
They keep clean? Was there a wet
didn't.
Wipe?
There was no.
No, it just smelled.
It just smelled. That's why they called them pig boats.
Oh, my.
Is when they came into port, they opened the hatches and the wives would run down and
then run back.
Yes.
I just did a big turn.
So that in touring the boat, we had toured the next day we toured the Nautilus, which was right there in Groton, Connecticut. And that was the U.S.'s first and the world's first nuclear submarine. And the strangest thing was in the officers' dining hall, the chairs were the same steel case chairs that you've sat in any government building with the green vinyl or blue vinyl. And on the brand spanking new, just commissioned USS Idaho, they had the exact same chairs.
Obviously didn't bring a designer in on that project.
And, well, they had the designer because they had all of these pictures from around Idaho
public
on the walls.
Public space designer.
And the only kind of new-looking chair were the pilot and co-pilot, which looked like gaming chairs in front of their consoles and had armrests with drink holders.
That's so fascinating.
So I'm so curious. You got to go to a commissioning of a brand-new naval submarine. Did again back to secrecy. It's so strange that they let. I mean, you're a civilian. That they allowed civilians on this boat that is now going to be out doing its service in the ocean. Did they have to like? Is it one of those things where you move all the important papers off the desk and tuck everything in drawers before you let people in your office?
Or what did you have to do to be able to do that? Like, what's your secret?
Oh, no, it just, you apply for it and send.
Background checks. And
Yeah. Okay. So just like if you were going to go to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. and get a White House tour.
Which I heard is very difficult.
Is you go through your congressman and they take your Social Security number and a copy of your driver's license and passport and the FBI checks you out and says yes or no. And so when our tickets showed up and. Then we said, okay, we're going.
Wow.
One is the world is probably much more paperless than you ever imagine.
True.
And so that the.
No one's hiding their Rolodex.
There was computer consoles everywhere to the point that my wife, you know, we've toured several submarines and. And she looked around the control room and said, where's the periscope? Oh. And I pointed to a TV, a display screen. And then I pointed at another one. And then I pointed at another one. And the seaman that was giving us the tour said, he's right, is that any screen could be what you can look out of the periscope. And, of course, there's no glass. I mean, instead of mirrors and light tubes... There, it's a camera up there, and they've got infrared and radar and all sorts of different imaging devices on the thing that we call a periscope. And so that there is nothing that sticks down and comes down like you see in the movies, you know, take her down. bandit.
So that's so fascinating. And I think of objects and how I love historical objects and to be able to touch them. How is that submarine? Obviously, it can be toured and it's an immersive experience, but no one would want to take that monitor off and have it in their home on a shelf and be like, wow. I mean, maybe, but not. It's not like the beautiful, like, leather-wrapped bronze, you know, hand-carved wood handles.
You know, the brass compass.
Yeah, exactly. That. All of those objects.
That tell the story.
That tell the story and the craftsmanship behind it. Today, we're in such like a technologically advanced world. And thinking about even those papers, Hannah, you were referencing, obviously we have original documents, but that's all digital, emails, like correspondence, all of that. Like, what is it going to look like 100 years from now or 500 in terms of archiving objects and so forth is kind of a fascinating thing I think about.
Well, again, is that none of these submarines will ever be museum ships for several reasons. One is that great big nuclear reactor in it. And none of the big aircraft carriers will ever be museum ships. All of the museum aircraft carriers are World War II or later Cold War carriers that have been rebuilt to be handle jets with catapults, but they all ran on fuel oil. And so that taking those parts out, and that's what they did with the Nautilus, is they took it back to the shipyard and cut a big hole and took the reactor out and buried it probably at Hanford and then welded a fake piece in there. So there's nothing to tour back there, the machine spaces and things like that. But yeah, in touring the Victory ships and World War I ships and the brass and all of that stuff, again, is you know, there's a reason for brass, is it doesn't rust.
Right.
We're talking to Ken Conger about submarines. Obviously, submarines around the world, but also here in Lake Pendere, or submersibles, I guess. However, there's a difference there, right? There's a difference between a submarine and a submersible. I'm not sure what it is. Submarine is its own self-contained thing, and a submersible has to have a ship to go with it or something. Do you know?
No, I don't.
But yes, me neither. That seems reasonable. Submersible's smaller. How about that? Have there ever been any manned craft under under the water in Lake Pendere, as far as we know? It could be Navy or other.
Very interesting. So talk about collections. I like to snoop around in the back of the museum.
Don't we all?
And several years ago, there was a gentleman that started some like UFO society in Coeur d'Alene or Rathdrum or Spokane, and came up here and did a bunch of research. And so there's a lot of little note cards about every single sighting of whatever in there.
This must be the McLeod research.
They've got typed up 3x5 cards.
So that was not UFO. That was
looking for Nessie or whatever.
Well,
The
Pendere Pillar. Is it 1985 or 1987? Crypto Quest by Dr. James McLeod.
Yes,
the University of Oregon.
So it.
That's a treasure box.
And so that in there's these 3x5 cards that have every newspaper article, which I can add mine to it now.
Of
every sighting of anything that was weird.
Under the lake.
Yeah. And so that, you know, when some of these things show up, you know, they talked about them. And Fred Kennedy, the tugboat guy, has a comment in there, is that in the 80s, well, there's a couple in there that are, somebody said so-and-so, that Jacques Cousteau was here and did some research. And then when he was contacted 10 or 20 years later, he didn't have any recollection of the conversation. So that there is one typed up card that, and I don't recall, but it's about in the 80s, that a submersible, maybe two-man submarine, went in at Hope, was seen going in at Hope. It was University of Pennsylvania research, and they were looking at a cave for some reason in the Green Barn Arcs.
Now that could be connected to the UFO.
So that is the only "quote unquote" submersible humans in the water.
So you're saying that's the only account that you've found?
Yes.
Is that little index card?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
And so that I've not yet been out to Hope and talk to Kennedy and see if he remembers that. But there probably have been small submersibles working at the Acoustic Research Detachment to do maintenance or other things in the water.
So you are confirming or saying that, like, no one
Senator,
really...
Senator, I will neither confirm nor deny the existence.
That no one really saw any of this happen. Like, they were able to keep it that much of a secret.
Which?
Like, this whole submarine concept. And that's why it has all these, like, myths associated with it.
Yes. Well, again, is
because it doesn't just pop out of the water and so-and-so's like, well, there's old, you know, cutthroat.
Yep.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the reason is, yes, there are times where people see them. It wasn't until 1910 that the Acoustic Research Detachment actually had an open house.
2010?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And I did say 1910.
Yeah.
And so yes, you'll be able to drive by and see things parked outside, but there's large, big boathouses there that you can see one right here, and things can be hidden inside until nighttime until they take them out.
So I'd like to think that there's so many layers to our worlds that we don't understand. But that being said, this really helps us understand why there is so much lore in our lake. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, can you imagine, like, just a little popping out of something, but not being able to have the information? That's where, like, the magic of storytelling really comes into play.
Yes, that's how myths.
Yes,
you know, is they saw somebody, you know, with a hairy face and the full moon. And,
well, that was David Thompson that gave us our first. That's another show, but I know you all are excited to hear that. But that is.
And every myth has a portion of truth, like the story of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Is, yes, she flew over a lake in North Idaho, just not the one that she is claimed to have discovered for her husband.
So fascinating.
I guess we have to talk to somebody at the University of Pennsylvania to figure out what they were doing and what they found underneath the water. Is that correct?
And that's why I'm so grateful for volunteers like Ken, because I, you know, working at the museum, I focus on what we have at the Bonner County History Museum, but you are out there looking through the National Archives and doing all of this external research that then helps us tell a fuller story.
Yeah. Well, that at least would not be top secret. You could perhaps, you know, somebody could go to the University of Pennsylvania and see what they found.
Globally appreciated all of what you've done. It's always such a treat to run into you. Your wealth of knowledge is so incredible. Have you been, obviously you've done an incredible job documenting everything and making sure it's in the archives of our local museum. Personally, like, do you have memoirs of your experiences? Because through this research, your life journey has become very fascinating as well.
You just have to talk to me.
We got to write it down.
That's the great thing about
oral history.
Audio technology is we can do a recording like this that will be saved on KRFY's website for all time.
So it is known that every time you run into Ken, you want to put your voice memo on record because the nuggets that you get from his conversations are very mesmerizing.
And in 1948, an area of erection of a range system is restricted. Since the end of World War II, the Navy has been conducting secret underwater experiments at Bayview. So those are the newspaper articles. And so, of course, it just adds and adds and adds.
Yeah.
It is something that, you know, as much as history is a search for the truth, it can be fallible at times. And, you know, sometimes we verge into storytelling more than fact finding. So always, always double check what you read.
Yeah. But that's actually, like, that's kind of the fun part about the history.
I did run some of this through ChatGPT or Gemini.
You don't use just, that.
It adds to the lore.
Just to ask specific questions.
Uh-huh.
And and it was so funny because, you know, it would come back with, you know, the Sandpoint Online information and things. And I would ask specifics about some of these things and dates, which there's, you know, a newspaper article. No such records exist.
Mm-hmm. I have noticed that it has a hard time pulling from newspaper archives.
Yeah.
I've tried to do the same thing before, and it does not.
Because
entertaining website basis.
They're photos. Mm-hmm. They're not text.
Yeah. Did we miss any big stories as we wrap up here? Were there any other anecdotes or anything we need to talk about? What else is underneath Lake Pend'Oreille or has been underneath Lake Pend'Oreille? Or shall we talk about what's coming up?
One thing about as the war was winding down, Farragut Naval Training Station became the repository, cleaner, and sorter of personal effects of people killed in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go through and pull out the contraband. They took out letters unless they had an envelope, so they wouldn't send a letter of a girlfriend home to the wife.
Oh, that's so smart.
Mm.
And they would pull out all of the contraband, like Japanese pistols and mortars and grenades and machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Samuelson, the former governor, was working there with all of the weapons. And he said that when they got a boatload full of them, they would take them out by Cape Horn and dump them in the deep end. So in 1,000 feet of water is a whole bunch of really cool rusty guns and stuff that I've got to, when I go get a tour of the site, I've been tracking down old people that have worked there, but I've got to find somebody because they have sonar and they can find things on the bottom.
Wow.
Somebody listening right now is heading out to their garage to build a submersible.
Yeah. Okay, we're over our time, folks. This is 88.5 KRFY Pend'Oreille. Real quick, what's coming up for the museum, the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum?
Yeah.
Calendar.
We've got a few events coming up before we wind down for the winter on September 5th. If you're listening to this live, we have our free first Saturday where the museum is open 10 to 2 and free admission. And we will also have hands-on history activities for kids. We are also coming down to our last couple of historic walking tours. Those are on Saturdays. You meet at the Cedar Street Bridge, and you can get tickets at bonnercountyhistory.org. The last one is on September 5th as well. And then our last big events of the fall on September 26th, at 8 p.m., which is a very late night for the museum, we are going to be doing an illuminated walking tour of Lakeview Cemetery. Where we will have three tour guides telling you about the life stories of some of the people who are buried there. The following day, on Sunday, September 27th, we are hosting what I hope will be the first annual event called the Then and Now Expo. We were inspired by the World's Fairs of way back when. So this will be sort of an innovation and technology fair where we will have different experts from local industries there showing how different pieces of technology from the logging industry, mining, milling, all kinds of things that have really built this area, They'll have different pieces of equipment and be talking about how that technology has changed over time. So that'll be a little sort of science fair expo we're doing out at the Sandpoint Organic Ag Center on September 27th.
That's so fun.
Very cool. All right. Well, folks, stay tuned for Bird Note and Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long here on 88.5 KRFY. Ken Conger has been our guest here on the Community Character Hour, and it's been fun talking about submarines with you, Ken. Thanks so much for your time and all your research.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Ken.
Okay, off to the next program here on Panhandle Community Radio.